Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. News about Russia continues to dominate headlines. You cannot turn on any of the cable shows without breaking news about Russia. So what is the real story here? Well, there's a lot of moving parts. The New York Times reports that 2 weeks before his inauguration, Donald Trump was shown highly classified intelligence indicating that Putin had personally ordered cyber attacks to influence the 2016 election. And then last Friday, special counsel Robert Mueller accused 12 Russian military intelligence officers of hacking Democrats' emails and computers. According to the indictment, Russian military intelligence officers had access to 33 DNC computers. Yesterday, the White House said Donald Trump plans to invite Vladimir Putin to Washington, D.C. in the fall. And Dan Coats, the director of national intelligence, learned about this news during an interview with NBC's Andrea Mitchell at a conference in Aspen, Colorado. This comes just days after Trump's private meeting and press conference with Putin in Helsinki, Finland. Joining us to talk about media coverage and where we really should focus our efforts on all of this and our attention are two guests. Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of the book Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Hi, Scott. Welcome back to the show.
Rose, great to be with you.
Great to have you. Greg Gordon is a veteran investigative reporter with McClatchy Newspapers. In January, Greg broke the story about the NRA's possible connection to Russian meddling during the election through a top banker in Russia. Hi, Greg. Welcome back to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Delighted to be here.
Great to have you. Great to have both of you. Before we dive in, as we always do on our media roundtables, we start off by highlighting journalism that stood out this week. So, Scott Horton, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, there's about an 8,000-word article that ran in the Financial Times magazine over the weekend by Tom Burgess, which was a minute, detailed dissection of exactly how Donald Trump pursued and built the Trump Tower in Toronto, and it had some real bombshells in it. It didn't get that much reverberation outside, but it was published online just as Trump was arriving in the UK, and some of the key passages in the article establish who his key business partner was, and that's a person who is the son-in-law of an individual known as the Quartermaster General of the KGB, Boris Bierstein, who also was involved in the project. And it also traces back where all the money came from. And when you move step by step by step all the way to the beginning, you see that the money came from Vanesh Ekonom Bank, which isn't really a bank. It's more like the rainy day fund of Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin. So that's astonishing.
You know, Scott, we saw this piece, and this is based on legal documents, signed statements, 24 interviews with people with knowledge of the project and the money that flowed through it. And this, as you said, Scott, is such a lengthy story. And there are several really great investigative pieces looking at Donald Trump's financial connections to bankers and oligarchs in Russia. It's hard to keep up with all of this, Scott. How should people kind of connect all the dots?
I think that's the problem here. And this piece was written in the Financial Times well-known style, which is, let's just put it this way, turgid, detail-obsessed. Mm-hmm. Every single detail, in fact, is stated there and is checked and verified 3 times, but no splashy headlines or big conclusions. I mean, you have to be patient and work all the way through it, and then think about what it means, because they're not going to tell you what it means. That's their style. And I think a lot of people who are following this avidly look for big, punchy headlines and for things that sizzle and don't want to go wading into a detailed maze of documents about financial dealings involving banks all around the world.
We had Craig Unger on the show a couple months back, and he wrote a lengthy piece in Vanity Fair looking at various financial transactions. And he said that this is just the tip of the iceberg. What he thinks is most important are Donald Trump's financial transactions and how they're connected to various Russians. Do you agree with that, Scott, or do you think that's one piece of the puzzle?
That's absolutely right. So I think if we saw what we saw in Helsinki, many people are scrambling to understand this. What does it mean? What does Trump have? What does Putin have on Trump that causes him to behave in such a way that he appears to be openly in the thrall of Vladimir Putin? And of course, people talk about compromising tapes and dealings with prostitutes and so forth. And I'm not going to dismiss that. That's part of the package. But the main thing, I mean, if you really understand how the art of kompromat works, how it's run by the Russian intelligence agencies, it's not as simple as all of that. It tends to, especially when dealing with businessmen, it tends to work in terms of very complex financial and business entanglements. So they want the people who is their target to be so beholden to them and have his business world so wrapped up in theirs and their financing and their business relationships that he can't say no to them. He can't even criticize them. And I think what we're seeing here now is that if we look at Trump's business world after his bankruptcies from 2004, 2005, 2006, when he rebuilt his business world, the money that's creating this business is coming from Russia. And it is flowing seemingly at the direction with the approval or with the influence of Putin and the Kremlin. And there are few cases that show that quite so starkly as the Trump-Toronto case. But, of course, we know when people studied the Soho Tower case, when they looked at the Panama Tower case as well as projects in Florida, over and over again, this is the same thing we're finding. The structures are very, very complex, but the money is Russian money.
Scott Horton is a contributing editor at Harper's, and he recommends a piece by the Financial Times journalist Tom Burgess. It's called Tower of Secrets, the Russian Money Behind a Donald Trump Skyscraper. And you can find links to that story at yourcallradio.org. What about you, Greg? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Scott stole my thunder, Rose.
Oh.
But I have to add a few things. I mean, that's a fantastic piece of journalism. I can't remember how many months they said they worked on it, but it was an exhaustive piece of reporting, and it filled in a lot of the blanks. But I think part of the picture here, and Scott, I thought you did a fabulous job in sort of laying out a lot of the context and a lot of the picture, big picture, about the Trump's relationship with Russia in terms of business. Donald Trump was some say he was in the real estate business, and then some snarky comments are that he was actually in the money laundering business, but that's got to be proved. He was, because of the fact he was in commercial real estate, when the financial crisis hit, commercial loans are not 30-year loans like we all get for our home mortgages. Some of them are 5 years, 10 years, and they're always rolling over. And so aside from the fact that he had bankruptcies on his record, which would have limited his ability to get credit with the big banks, but he also had the problem of the financial crisis hitting, and he had to somehow obtain credit. And there have been reports out there about this big loan that he got from Deutsche Bank, and the big question mark has been, okay, how did he get that loan? Who guaranteed it? And of course, the Russians, were their intelligence agencies, if they were involved in something like that, would disguise it and make sure there was plausible deniability around it. But if that occurred, that would be one way. We know already that an oligarch paid $95 million for a mansion from Trump. We know that Russians occupy a large percentage of the condominiums in the untold numbers of, it's a big number of condo projects that he's been involved with, either licensing his name or as an owner. So this is another big piece of the puzzle. Trying to figure out, where did this money come from? What was the path? And I think that Burgess or just put another nail into the story to try to drive home what happened. We'll have to see what Bob Mueller has, because Bob Mueller is holding his cards very close to the vest. If you read the court filings in the Maria Butina case that unfolded this week, this being the alleged Russian operative who came here, she set up a group like the National Rifle Association called the Right to Bear Arms in Russia, even though Putin doesn't really like his citizenry to be owning more than hunting rifles. And then she comes over here and starts hobnobbing with the NRA, as is her mentor or boss, as she sometimes refers to him in the documents that the FBI obtained, the deputy governor of Russia's central bank, Alexander Torshin. And Torshin has a checkered past, to say the least, because he was charged by Spanish authorities with laundering money for the Russian mob into Spanish banks and hotels. So now you have Torshin, who came here, became a lifetime member of the NRA, and you have Butina, now under the one Russian who's now in jail, and they're keeping their watch on her and making sure that she remains there and doesn't get out of the country. And we'll see what that case goes. But as you mentioned, Rose, we reported early on this year that the NRA was, well, not that, that the FBI was, I'm going to be very precise, the FBI was investigating whether Torshin funneled money to the NRA to help the NRA in its support of Trump. And the NRA spent $30 million to help Trump win the White House. So now we're seeing this matter unfold. And the question is, are we going to get to money? That's one of the big questions as far as I'm concerned. Are we going to get to money? We know that the FBI didn't open an investigation of such a sensitive matter, Trump's biggest supporter, because just for the heck of it, they had something. They knew of something, and we reported late last month that the FBI likely has the nonprofit tax returns that the NRA files with the IRS, which discloses its dark money donors. These are the donors whose identities are protected. They're shielded from the public, and the government, up until now, because they just changed the rules in this administration, but up until now, the IRS was a repository of the identities of all these dark money donors. So think of this. Of the $30 million that the NRA spent on Trump that we know about, because there are other ways that they legally can spend money on supporting a presidential candidate, like get out the vote and so forth. But of the money we know about, $23 million was spent by an arm, the lobbying arm of the NRA, that does not have to disclose its donors. I'm not saying that we know that this money included money from Russia. The NRA denies it. Still under investigation, but I'm just saying Torshin was not included in that indictment. Why? Because, other Russians have been indicted by Mueller, even though they're residing over there. So why was Torshin left out? Is there another big piece of this coming?
All right, you brought up a lot of points there, Greg. And
sorry to go on.
No, it's okay. I mean, this is our reality. Our head is spinning. It's hard to follow all of this. But NPR's Peter Overby had a piece yesterday about how the IRS announced rule changes on Monday night, saying that it no longer, big money groups no longer have to identify their biggest donors to the IRS. So basically, dark money is getting a little darker.
Well, and just think about this, okay? In the story we wrote last month, we laid out what the standard is for getting a glimpse of who these donors are when you're in law enforcement. You don't have to go to a grand jury and get a subpoena issued, or you didn't have to until this regulation changed. Before, the standard was if you have a reasonable cause to believe that a crime was committed, then you go to a magistrate or a judge, and wham, you're in the files, and it's all done secretly. Now, the grand jury, of course, is secret too, but there's a tougher standard, and so basically, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin has now said that these big donors, small donors, who are anonymous, have more secrecy than before.
Greg Gordon is a veteran investigative reporter with McClatchy Newspapers. In January, Greg broke a story called FBI Investigating Whether Russian Money Went to the NRA to Help Trump. His lead says the FBI is investigating whether a top Russian banker with ties to the Kremlin illegally funneled money to the NRA to help Donald Trump. And the NRA did spend $30 million to elect Trump. We're also joined today by Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Scott and Greg do so much reporting on Russia. As you can hear, they could probably talk for the whole hour on their own, giving us information about Russia. So if you have any questions, because I'm sure a lot of you are listening to the news and wondering, what is the real story here? Where should I be putting my focus? We'd love to hear from you. What do you think about this nonstop coverage on Russia? This is a big moneymaker for the corporate media, specifically the cable shows. That's why they're on it 24/7. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Scott, there are so many moving parts to all of this. What is the most significant piece? I mean, where should we put our attention? Because there's just so much happening so quickly. And well, how do you think the media are really doing, giving people information with some substance and depth?
I think the media is doing a fine job. I mean, the part of the problem may be that there's just so much on the media, certainly on the cable TV shows, all the time, that people feel a bit inundated and lost in all the detail. But I don't know. I mean, I think we may in a certain way be back in the golden days of expose journalism. We've seen good work coming out of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and many, many other publications. And certainly also McClatchy has done terrific work. It makes me think back of the days of Watergate when we were getting these sorts of bombshells. But, you know, what should we be focused on right now? I mean, I think that there are really two stories of great importance. I mean, one of them is the follow the money trail. So we're seeing more and more of the money story unraveling. And what we're seeing continuously coming out of it is foreign money coming into the president's pockets, and particularly money that's tied with Russia, with Russian oligarchs, Russian organized crime, and so forth. That there's also indications of money coming from Middle Eastern rulers as well, but very heavily money from governments. So that's one big piece of the story. The other big piece is the continued unraveling of the tale of the active measures campaign that the Russians have operated. And there, of course, we had a particularly big shoe drop with the indictment of the 12 GRU officers. But I think, just as was being pointed out, this is just another handful of pebbles in a big mosaic. And if you read very carefully, the indictment of the GRU officers, just like the criminal complaint against Maria Butina, you see in both cases the prosecutors are very carefully telling us that there's much, much more there. There are more individuals, more people, more to the operations, which we can expect to come. And with the 12 GRU officers, what are we missing? We're missing how they got that information out into the public space. That's largely the story of their dealings with Julian Assange, which is presented in sort of a preliminary sketch there, and also how some of this information winds up in the hands of the Trump campaign. And based on what's been reported and what's contained in these complaints, I think we're now at the stage of knowing with a very high level of likelihood that we're going to see further indictments of people who were in prominent roles inside that campaign, Roger Stone certainly being one. So I think that's those are the points I'd be have my focus on right now.
And what about you, Greg? When you sit down to decide where to put your focus, how do you make those decisions? And what would you say is the real story here?
Well, there are multiple elements to this story, but here's how I kind of look at the Mueller investigation. And this is true of many criminal investigations. If you're investigating the mob, you have these challenges. Okay, so the Mueller team is investigating. It's doing a criminal investigation. It's also doing a counterintelligence investigation to see what the Russians did, so they can figure out for the future how to combat that. But the Mueller investigation it's impeded because half of the people involved in any of the communications, and there have been more than 50 communications between the Trump campaign and Russian significant Russian players. Documented by the news media, so you have these people who are in Russia who are just out of reach of Bob Mueller. So if he wants to find out what happened as far as the collusion story goes, he has to basically get Trump's people to sort of carve each other up. He's got to get them find. Violations of the law, force them into plea agreements, as he has with several players already now. We have Michael Flynn, we have Gates, who was Manafort's deputy, we have Papadopoulos, the former foreign policy advisor, and then there's the lawyer and other players. But in the United States, these are the people, and we don't know what Flynn has told Bob Mueller. We don't know what Gates has told Mueller. He was deputy to the campaign chairman for Trump for a while, as well as his role with his business role with Manafort over in the Ukraine. But the other big piece is Michael Cohen, who is, as you know, we've just learned today that he's got a tape recording. The New York Times is reporting that he's got a tape recording of him talking to the to Donald Trump about a payment to a Playboy model a couple of months before the election. So what's going to come out of all these documents and tape recordings have been seized from Michael Cohen and whether it will force him to cop a plea. And if he cops a plea, then we get down to what's he going to say. Is he going to confirm that he was in Prague in late summer of 2016 talking to a Russian legislator and in the presence of hackers? And that's what the dossier compiled by British spy, former ex-British spy Chris Steele, laid out. And, of course, I just think this has been described by one investigator as the Holy Grail. Because think about if that is confirmed. And, of course, my colleague, my partner, Peter Stone and I reported a while back that in April, I believe, that Michael Cohen was indeed in Prague, that he entered through Germany. We quoted what we said is that the FBI has evidence that he was in Prague. I want to be careful about this. Whether they have proof of it remains to be seen, but if that is confirmed, that's a centerpiece of this whole thing as far as whether there was collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. Scott's absolutely right about the money. Follow the money. The money trail is just as important. It's hard to know whether how far Bob Mueller is going to get because he has these impediments. He has a small circle of witnesses. They were loyalists to Donald Trump, and he's trying to turn them, as it occurred in Watergate.
Hold that thought, Greg. We're going to take a quick break. Today, it is Your Calls Media Roundtable. That is McClatchy's Greg Gordon. We're also speaking with Harper's Scott Horton. And we'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call on the phone by sending an email to yourcall@kalw.org or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate, In today's show now, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about Russia, and we are trying to make sense of all of this, connect the dots. What is the most important news that we are getting on a regular basis about Donald Trump's connections to Vladimir Putin and bankers in Russia? When we follow the money, what are the most important stories? We're talking about it with Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's and author of Lords of Secrecy. Greg Gordon is a veteran investigative reporter with McClatchy. In January, he broke the story on the NRA's possible connection to Russian meddling during the election through a top Russian banker. And because there are many moving parts, in case you're not following some of the stories that Greg and Scott are bringing up, I just want to give you the information so you have the context. Greg just mentioned the New York Times story that just broke about Michael Cohen secretly taping Trump discussing payment to a Playboy model. Here's the lead. Trump's longtime lawyer, Michael Cohen, recorded a conversation with Trump 2 months before the election in which they discussed payments to a former Playboy model who said she had an affair with Trump, according to lawyers and others familiar with the recording. The FBI seized the recording this year during a raid on Cohen's office, and the DOJ is investigating Cohen's involvement in paying women to tamp down news stories about Trump ahead of the election. So I just wanted to give you that news in case you didn't hear about it yet. And we've got a couple of callers on the line, actually full lines. Let's go to Rachel in Menlo Park. Hi, Rachel. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. And I really appreciate you having your guest on today talking about a story that I would have otherwise not heard about. So just a little background. I used to work in D.C. I'm in my 20s, and so now being outside of that world, I don't get to watch congressional hearings on a daily basis. I don't get to really be in the action and really explore policy anymore. And the mainstream media, in a lot of ways, I feel like is sometimes aiding and abetting this smokescreen that Donald Trump's administration is putting over all of us. We're focusing on all of these non-important horse and pony show issues, like the Peter Strzok trial, hearing. Why was that all over the news for like 3 days? It's so such an antithesis to the real problems that are going on. So I'm really grateful to hear stories like this one, where Russia is obviously having more of a hand in other areas in our society that I otherwise would not have heard about. So this NRA thing is a really valid, credible point that I'm sure no one's going to pay attention to, because there's just going to be something else thrown on the media that's going to be more sensational to grab our attentions with and fill up our Facebook feeds with.
Well, Rachel, I'm so glad to hear that, because we really, when we come up with these shows, especially about Russia, we always think, all right, what's the best way we can use this time? So thank you so much. And again, you mentioned Peter Strzok. He was a former lead agent on FBI investigations into the Hillary Clinton and Trump campaigns, and he testified before Congress. Republicans went after him, and, you know, it was covered nonstop because it makes for good TV. So thank you for calling, Rachel. Let's go next to Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Well, thank you very much for all this new information and information that's out there that we can access. I think it's really important to see how corrupt Trump is. But I want to remind people of one thing, and it's kind of related to the show you did yesterday, that the emails that were revealed about Hillary and that Julian Assange helped us read were really about the dirty tricks of the DCCC against the progressive wing of the party. And so while I despise Russia for helping Trump, I also have to thank them for showing us what's going on in our party. Or some of our
parties. Well,
there's that. And Scott, I was thinking about timing last night. When we got access to the Hollywood Access tape, when Trump said he grabs women's, you know what, were the Podesta emails released right after that Hollywood Access tape?
Within hours. That's
within
exactly
hours.
Right. So, I mean, okay. So clearly this was an effort to distract attention from what Trump's own team viewed as an event that was potentially hugely damaging.
Wow.
Absolutely, and that timeline is so important to evaluate what happened there in early October. We've had tips about that, but we haven't been able to confirm whether there was communication between the campaign and the Russians, and just another additional big question marks about was there some kind of a link?
Well, and this goes to the Mueller indictment. And if you read the indictment, I mean, there's so much damning information in there. According to the indictment, Russian hackers activated a number of key logs, screenshot functions, armed with DNC login credentials. They were able to access approximately 33 DNC computers. And once on the network, they compromised a DNC Microsoft Exchange server, gaining access to thousands of emails. And then one specific example, on April 14th, Russian military agents surveilled a DCCC employee's computer for 8 hours. At that time, they captured communications with coworkers and passwords. What else really stands out for you in the latest Mueller indictment, Greg?
Just the astounding detail it's a signal. Because one observation I would make is that Bob Mueller, every single thing that's come out of that shop has been immaculately documented. it's been rock solid. When I first was assigned, I hate to say this because it's going to signal that I'm 100 years old, but when I was first assigned to the Justice Department in 1978, Griffin Bell was Attorney General in the Carter administration, and I remember Griffin Bell always talking about how the standard at the Justice Department for bringing an indictment was at least a 51% chance of conviction. I would say that nothing's going to come out of the Mueller shop. Well, of course, convicting the Russians is going to be pretty hard, so let's set that aside. But anything else that comes out of that shop is going to be about an 85 to 95% chance of conviction. And that's probably one reason why we're unlikely to see him attempt to prosecute the president for obstruction of justice. And one observation I've always made about that, by the way, is that, he fired Jim Comey. But who replaced Jim Comey? Bob Mueller. So it's kind of hard it's a nice defense to say, what are you talking about, obstruction of justice? Look who's leading the investigation, the former FBI director who was held over beyond his 10-year term for another 2 years because he was so well-regarded. So I think that makes it less likely. And plus, prosecuting a president is a legal question that a Supreme Court with Judge Kavanaugh likely confirmed to join will be a very tough case to bring for any special prosecutor, special counsel. So I think that. Going forward, that's going to be one of the challenges here. But he's not going to take, so he's going to have these things really, really nailed. And I think going back to your question, which I guess I've evaded, sorry, the astounding detail, the ability of the counterintelligence division of the FBI to document all that stuff. And piecing it together like an espionage case is amazing. And the same thing for the earlier indictment of the social media operation, the troll farm. Same thing. Just amazing.
And Greg, since you're talking about the Mueller team and the amazing detail, we should also note that Mueller's team includes some of the best prosecutors in the country. It includes men and women who brought down Richard Nixon and Enron.
Right. he's got that lineup. And now, I will make one other note, you know, that interestingly, the Maria Butina indictment regarding her relationship with the NRA and with politicians in the United States came out of the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia, and the Cohen investigation is being conducted out of the Southern District of New York. This is a massive investigation going on, and don't think for a minute that Bob Mueller isn't being apprised of all developments of note of significance in those cases. He's racing the clock. When he was FBI director, he always had a very firm rule about not bringing politically related prosecutions close to the election. So, you know, some people think Labor Day is the cutoff here. Well, less than 6 weeks or about 6 weeks from now. So things are happening very quickly right now, and that could continue up until Labor Day. We'll have to see. And I don't see this investigation ending by Labor Day, but things are moving.
Greg Gordon is a veteran investigative reporter with McClatchy, and Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's. Scott, we have a question from Catherine in Richmond. She says, your guests talk about this being a golden age of expose journalism. If that is so, why have heads not rolled yet, so to speak? You know, she goes on to talk about Watergate and the story leading to the resignation of Nixon, who was under threat of impeachment.
Well, I think if we go back to, I lived through the Watergate age myself. I'm also of that age. And if we remember how it worked, I mean, when the first news and first reports of it broke, there was shock. There was some outrage, but it actually did take quite a bit of time and quite a bit of reporting over time to build up a political head of steam that forced political consequences, including resignations. And between that time and this time, there's a major change that's occurred in the body politic of the United States. And I'd summarize that change with the name Rupert Murdoch. Roger Ailes lived through Watergate too. He thought that it showed a key weakness of the Republican Party, which is that Republicans were too susceptible to mainstream media, too subject to their influence. He wanted to set up a new media which would be there to keep them loyal to Republicans even in times of crisis, and I think we see the effects of that. I think Roger Ailes accomplished what he intended to accomplish, and we see that in polling today that shows, notwithstanding all the disclosures, and even following Helsinki and the NATO summit, we've got a steady somewhere between 35% and 40% figure, which is an overwhelming majority of Republicans backing Trump. And I think as long as Trump has that strong support from inside the Republican Party, it doesn't matter that large majorities of the public as a whole view him critically, or even that a plurality would like to see him impeached and removed from office. Actually, the last polls show that the percentage of Americans who would like to see Trump impeached and removed from office are right around where they were when, Nixon was forced to resign.
And several media outlets, including The Atlantic, The Independent, The Huffington Post, have articles about Trump supporters thanking Russia for its help in 2016. Thank you for the email, Catherine. Let's go next to Kathleen in San Francisco. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Thank you. Well, it's more or less the same subject I was just going to say. With all of this information that appalls us, it does not appall Trump's base. They're for him no matter what, right or wrong. They don't really care if he loves Russia better than our own intelligence. That doesn't matter to them. They will do whatever. But the worst part is, so will the Senate, our own Senate, you know, because of being mostly Republican. I just couldn't believe that they were not outraged. But they will not do anything to harm Trump, especially as the election approaches. And it shows where we've gotten to be at a place that this is the case, that we can't do anything about it in the Senate, because it's still, even with this last debacle in Europe and Finland, and that it's going to still be the same thing, the same he has the same protection and loyalty from the Republicans. It's just appalling.
Well, thank you for that, and I'm glad you brought that up because you reminded me about this other piece of news that's very important. Yesterday, House Republicans voted down a Democratic effort to increase election security spending. In a vote right along party lines, Republicans rejected Democrats' motion for more funding. The funding obviously is happening amidst all this news. And Greg, you have written about electronic voting machines in the past.
I have. A lot.
What do you think about the significance of the Republicans voting down a bill that would increase election security spending?
It's stunning. But look, if my memory is correct, the Congress did allot $380 million for new equipment for the states. We reported a while back, a couple months ago, that 14 states today have either parts or all of 14 states have paperless voting machines. And what that means is that these electronic machines don't have a backup so that if you wanted to audit to make sure there were no shenanigans played with the vote, no tampering, you can't do it. And after all of the work done by cybersecurity experts over the years and all of the exposés about weaknesses in security, it is stunning to me. And by the way, there are Republicans who have been very involved in supporting more security. And now we find this vote happening after revelations that the Russians knocked on the doors, basically, cyber operatives in Russia knocked on the doors of state election offices or their election systems, attempting to penetrate their voter registration databases. Aside from the fact that they also managed to penetrate a Florida-based voting vendor. So, and by the way, $380 million is less than $10 million per state. And a lot of states have like 80 counties. And some of the counties, well, basically one state might spend, if they get the more expensive equipment, might spend $40 to $100 million just to upgrade. However, there is equipment available where you could just have a paper ballot and it's scanned by an optical scanner and it costs about a third of the electronic equipment prices. So, you know, you kind of scratch your head and you say, okay, we have some pretty savvy marketing people at these voting equipment vendors, but we have a lot of knowledge in the government now. The Department of Homeland Security has been advising the states on what they need to do. We know that the secretaries of state have dug their heels in. They don't want any federal intervention. They have sovereignty, so to speak, over voting equipment and the voting process. But why the resistance? It's mind-numbing.
and as you reported last month, Greg, the largest voting equipment vendor in the country, Election Systems and Software, based in Nebraska, has for at least 9 years coaxed state and local election officials to serve on an advisory board that gathers twice annually for a company-sponsored conference, including last year at the Ritzy Las Vegas Resort Hotel. And the Post quotes Jim Jordan, a Republican from Ohio, who leads the House Freedom Caucus, that conservative caucus, saying, quote, "I don't know what we need for safe and secure." He said, "I know what we need for safe and secure elections, and that is voter ID, which suppresses the vote." So next week, on our Friday show, we're going to talk about these voting machines, because so many people are now saying that in order to have actual safe elections, we need to go back to paper ballots. Is that what you're hearing, Greg, from anyone in D.C.? Right. I want to ask both of you, we've got just a couple minutes left. Stephen Walt is a professor of international relations at Harvard, and he wrote a pretty damning column for Foreign Policy. He said, quote, "If this were any other presidency, Donald Trump would be toast. But that is not happening because people do not trust foreign policy establishment. He says that the elite foreign policy establishment does not have a lot of credibility anymore. After all, this bipartisan cast of national security managers are responsible for open-ended NATO expansion. They failed to prevent 9/11. They conceived, supported, or went along with the invasion of Iraq. I mean, the list is very long. Scott Horton, what do you think about Stephen Walt's argument?
Well, he's identifying a core piece of the populist movement that's going on all across Europe in particular for the past several years. The Europeans, by and large, weren't involved in the invasion of Iraq, but nevertheless, the populists there do attack the entire leadership, the foreign policy establishment, and pin on them everything that's going wrong with society. And their argument is they shouldn't be trusted, they shouldn't be listened to. And if we look at what happened in Europe between the wars in the 20s and early 30s, this is also a major tactic that was used by the political parties on the far right and the far left. Both the communists and the fascists have used it. So it's nothing particularly new and surprising, and it is something very, very dangerous. But I think the core of his analysis is correct. This is an argument that's carrying some weight with it, and it is very, very persuasive to the Trump Republicans. And that's the reason why we see Trump Republicans now doing a 180-degree flop on a long list of issues without studying them. And that's, for instance, mm-hmm. the question of tariffs. Where they now are endorsing the idea of a trade war, where the Republican Party was absolutely against that just a few years ago. Not that there's been a study, a thinking through of it. They're simply following Trump.
Hmm. We have another question from a listener, and maybe you can take this one, Greg. Ruby writes in, first of all, she thanks both of you for your work. She says, what do you think of the July 8th and 9th New York Magazine lengthy piece that laid out many of the Trump-Russia connections? Don Jr. was quoted as saying, and she's paraphrasing, we don't need American banks. We have Russian banks financing us. And Ruby wrote, what in caps? Why isn't this getting more play? Greg?
Well, it has. I mean, there was, I think it was Don Jr., it might have been Eric, who was with the golf writer and made a comment about all the financing they got from Russia. The problem is we have to document everything. You can't just, you can't just write it. You have to go out and brick by brick, come up with the evidence for a story, and we all have to be fact-based reporters. And I would say that there's an extraordinary collaboration, not with any collusion of news reporters, investigative reporters across Washington and elsewhere who've been trying to get the truth out. But mm-hmm. that's a piece of it. We don't know. We don't know. Okay, so he said, in one place, $100 million of financing helped them with their golf courses and et cetera. We don't know where it came from. Godspeed. Let's find out if it's true. If it's true, it ought to be absolutely reported by the mainstream news organizations.
Thank you for the email, Ruby. We have another email from Mira, and maybe you can take this one, Scott. She writes, I'm curious if the most disturbing issue is not specifically the meddling of Russia in our elections, but rather the rise of the billionaire class and the consequent power of oligarchs in the U.S. and overseas to corrupt the political process. She says, it's interesting that the rise of extreme right-wing and authoritarian movements has coincided with the rise of the neoliberal economic policies promoted by both Democrats and Republicans in the U.S. What do you think about that, Scott?
I'd point to the column that Andrew Solomon has just posted in the New Yorker. That's just in the last couple of hours, in which he says that there is just a remarkable coincidence in views and techniques between Trump and Putin. So both of them are embracing a vision of the world. It's really not neoliberal economic orders. It's almost state capitalism is the way it's usually referred to, where the state is in the control of a small group of oligarchs who use it to pursue their own economic interests. That's sort of the core of Putin and Putin's world, and it aligns very closely with Trump and what he's up to. And, of course, neoliberalism, or let's say traditional liberalism, would involve some constraint or limitation on the rise of oligarchs historically, would involve spurs to competition. So it's not quite the same thing, but I certainly see what the commenter is, where she's coming from.
Greg, do you have anything to add?
Well, look, I mean, we've seen through the Panama Papers, we've seen a lot about kleptocrats moving money out of countries, of government leaders being involved in same. We've seen now through this Russia story how the Russian oligarchs, I mean, I was amazed. There was a line in the prosecutor's description of one of Maria Butina's contacts, or actually her funder, saying that he was described as informed by Forbes magazine as having $1.2 billion. So we all looked up on Forbes magazine's 2018 list of billionaires, and there were 12 Russian oligarchs who had a net worth of $1.2 billion. The list was so long. I was just blown away. What's happening to the people at the bottom? Where is all the money going in these countries around the world? This is I think at the root of a lot of what the populist movement ought to be looking at, because they're missing it.
Right. Well, and you had Maria Butina in your piece back in January, and for the first time, people are learning about her, a 29-year-old Russian gun rights activist. Rolling Stone describes her as spending years ingratiating herself with the NRA, as well as Republican politicians and conservative notables. How are you going to follow this story, Greg?
As best as we can, but it may be that we'll be following Bob Mueller's footsteps, I would say, going forward. But if he doesn't get there, the investigative reporters are gonna do what they can on their own to try to piece this together. Some of this stuff is you need law enforcement tools to get to it.
Right. And Scott, you started the show by asking a question: what does Putin have on Trump? Do you think that media are asking that question in that way enough?
I think this week they were, but we have a lot of digging to go to get to a plausible answer for it. I'm coming out to pretty much where Greg has come out too on the whole show involving Michael Cohen. So I think if he was in Prague, and I think there's more and more evidence pointing that way, and if he does do a deal with Mueller, we're going to learn a great deal more detail about all that.
Scott Horton is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, and Greg Gordon is a veteran investigative reporter with McClatchy Newspapers. Greg and Scott, thank you for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rose.
Thank you so much, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your Calls Media Roundtable.